have no idea. Okay, folks, we have started recording. It is June 2nd, 2022. I am a little bit behind with getting these recordings up, as I usually am. Just making sure I am on the right microphone here. Yeah, not altogether. I mean, I have it's election day, and I haven't filled out my ballot. That's how organized I am right now. It's not good. Nonetheless, well, California has been somewhat confusing in what in terms of what to do, as you fellow Californians know. The things that are kind of floating above my head, maybe you might not be able to see them, but they're there. Not just I kind of pull from them generally. Like, should I talk about that? So I'm just kind of realizing that I'm feeling like I'm in a bit of a transition state. I'm going to go on a self retreat in a couple of weeks, which I haven't done I haven't done this year, and so I am counting on the power of the Dharma to clarify things and help me make decisions moving forward. In any case, we are here to practice and to reflect on recovery and Dharma. And so we begin with a period of meditation. Oh, there's people in the, I have to keep my eyes up in the waiting room, the waiting room. We begin with a period of 20 minutes of meditation. I think, yeah, we should be able to start. I'm going to kind of peek occasionally at the screen to see if anybody's showing up late. It's a nice heart, thank you. I'm not sure what earned that, but we'll maybe of the fact that we're going to meditate, I guess. Yeah, fair. Okay, so just settling into a comfortable posture. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And beginning with just a general sense of how your body feels, how you feel right now, both physically, emotionally, energetically. As you come into stillness, the awareness of the energies that are inside you right now tends to come into awareness. When we're moving and active, we don't really feel everything that is kind of flowing through the mind and body because we are just flowing with it, so to speak. But when we stop the body, close the eyes and turn the attention away from the external and from activity, we can get in touch with the subtler underlying feelings. So here is where we invite the breath into to hold these feelings, to breathe with these feelings. Again, whether they be physical or mental, emotional, just breathing with your current mind-body state. And even this simple action, this simple shift in attention Can be challenging because these underlying energies are not always pleasant. One of the reasons we are busy in our lives and in our minds is that we are, in some sense, avoiding being with that. Those energies, those feelings. It's not that there's some big issue or big problem. It's just that life itself, having a body, having a mind, is inherently dukkha, unsatisfactory. There's a persistent feeling of incompleteness or needing something to be different. This is the human condition that the Buddha points to. Our practice is not to change that condition, but rather to change the need to an acceptance. Not struggle with things as they are. Not try to fix or control, but to allow and again, the breath is our partner in this process. When we pay attention to the breath, we feel how it opens us. It softens. And if there is any effort involved in this, it is to allow the breath to open us, to allow it to soften us, to allow it to help us be receptive to these mind-body states. Another word, another framing of this quality of acceptance and receptivity is kindness, gentleness, quality of loving kindness. If that resonates for you, to meet each moment with kindness. This doesn't mean that the resistance or the fear or anxiety, sadness, that any of these qualities of dukkha just disappear because we are bringing mindfulness and kindness to our experience. Rather, these elements of receptivity and acceptance are ways of holding whatever forms of dukkha are here for us. Our minds, our thoughts try to solve, to analyze, to figure out. How to control our experience. And in doing that, the mind winds up complicating what can be much simpler. Turning toward the experience, breathing with the experience. Non-resistance, non-control. And this is non-verbal, which is another challenge for us, because we tend to operate so much on this verbal level. Part of this process is to learn how to be with things without language, just through this direct feeling, direct being with. Okay. Is the bell sounding loud enough these days? There was somewhere that they were like it wasn't that loud. So yeah, I'm not sure if I need to hit it louder or I can turn up my microphone too.
I heard it.
What say what?
I heard it.
You heard it, right? Just yeah. I mean, I don't know.
But very soft.
It's very soft. Okay. Well, I'll keep that in mind because in the past it's been like loud too. It could also have to do with people's own speakers, you know, huh? So there's that. But anyway, little dust on my screen. So good morning again. I have been going through a classic in the modern Buddhist canon from Jack Kornfield, and Paula will know this. So, the book A Path with Heart, which I'm using as an instructional, some of the chapters are instructional purposes. And if you don't have this book, was published in 1993, I recommend it. I think there was a time when I think a lot of people in recovery were reading this book, at least in my circles, so whatever that is. But you know, as tends to happen, books fade from people's memory, and or they get dusty on the bookshelf. And but one of the things about Dharma is that it's timeless, and I noticed this recently when I was looking at some old issues of the Inquiring Mind magazine. And I was like, well, these are just like, you know, as contemporary as anything. I want to actually put in, I should put in some links since I don't have Monica to handle things. I'm going to put in the link to my Donna page for those who would like to support my teaching, and then I will get back to work. Here we go. There, if you want to offer anything. So anyway, it's a great book, A Path with Heart. Jack Kornfield, the subtitle is A Guide Through the Perils and Promises of Spiritual Life. And, you know, when I read this, I was already an experienced Buddhist practitioner, and I would have been about 7 or 8 years sober. I got sober in 85. So, and a lot of it was kind of familiar to me, but it just like put it all together. It arrived at the right time for me. And there's one chapter in particular that I really find incredibly helpful. And as I looked through it, I saw how much of my own practice and certainly my own teaching has been influenced by just this book. And thank you, Helen, for putting in a link to the book. Very good. And thanks everybody for helping out with just like, you know, clarifying for people who are like, what's he talking about? So this is chapter 8. I'm just going to read from it. It's called Difficult Problems and Insistent Visitors. And it comes after the chapter Naming the Demons, where he goes through the five hindrances. So he's kind of referring back to that, but it's kind of, you know, the book is kind of building, not an argument, but sort of building a process for us. So, okay, it starts out, in the course of our practice of naming the common demons and hindrances, we may come to encounter the underlying forces that cause them to return over and over again. Fear, confusion, anger, and ambition often appear as insistent visitors in our meditation. Even after we feel we should know better, they will come again anyway. Now we must look more deeply into how to work with the repeated difficulties that arise in our spiritual life. Well, I think just the opening sentence, we may come to encounter the underlying forces that cause them, the demons, to return over and over again. And this is, the notes I made for my students on this was like, this is the common struggle of people in meditation, right? We come to meditation, and maybe at first it's like, oh, this is great, I feel more relaxed, blah, blah, blah. But the more we do, it's like the more complicated it becomes. Like you start out and it's like simple. Okay, you just do this, follow the breath, and the mind wanders come back, okay. But after a while, stuff starts popping up, or you keep getting stuck in cycles, and maybe you go on a retreat, and things get good, but then they get bad, and so you start to realize, like, on the surface this is simple, but there's something else going on here. So then he tells this story about how he was teaching a retreat. And he was supposed to give the guided meditation on loving kindness, but he had just had an argument over the phone with his girlfriend. And this is, I kind of love this because he's like, he's giving the instruction. He says, we say, may my heart be filled with loving kindness. May I be peaceful. I would pause so the students would be able to sense these qualities inside. During the pauses, the conversation flooded back, and I found myself thinking, when this is over, I'm going to call her and tell her a thing or two. Then I would say out loud, think of another person you love and extend your kindness to them. And the next pause would come, that immature and neurotic woman, when I talk to her. And on it goes. It's nothing like that, of course, has ever happened to me as a teacher, thankfully. He then has a great poem from Kabir, and I'll just footnote here. Some years ago, I just stopped reading poetry in my teaching because, first of all, I don't really read poetry, and but so sorry. I mean, I know for those who are poetry people, and that I consider that a failing. So not being judgmental, but it's just not. But anyway, and this book, he used to quote a lot from the Kabir book, which was translations from Robert Bly, who's, he's got his own backstory. And Kabir was like a 12th century something Indian poet who wasn't a Buddhist, though. And that's ultimately why I stopped reading Kabir poems, even though I really like them, because they often point to things that are really relevant to our practice. But anyway, that's a footnote. Okay. So basically what he does with this chapter is he first points out that, when you're in in practice, and when you're serious about practice, and over time you'll start to see that, as he calls them, you have insistent visitors. And at one point he calls them like the top 10, your top 10 things that show up. And so anybody who's been practicing for a while, is familiar with these kind of experiences. And the question of how to deal with that, with those things, the questions are some of the most persistent questions we find in practice, and certainly as a teacher, and anybody who's, trying to help somebody with meditation knows, like, people kept coming back with these, like, why can't I do this? Why my stuff? I keep stuff. What do I do about this pain? What do I do when I'm depressed? What do I do when I'm anxious? So, I was kind of referring to this in the guided meditation about how we try to figure it all out and solve it with our heads, right? And this is what human beings do. This is our strength, right? It's our ability to think. And it doesn't work with emotions. So he talks about, again, what I talk about so much, which is just turning toward the experience. So let me read a little bit more. How can we understand what perpetuates the difficulties we encounter? Once we can name the demons as they come and go, our heart can hold them more lightly. Without judgment, we become what Ram Dass calls a connoisseur of our neuroses. Then we are ready for a deeper opening for understanding what is at their root. With more careful attention, we will sense that each demon and hindrance is an emotional or spiritual contraction, and that each is generated out of fear. It is this contraction and grasping that the Buddha described as the source of all human suffering. In the first years of my own practice and teaching, like any normal student, I struggled with restlessness, lust, doubt, and anger. I somehow believed it was these forces that were at the root of my suffering. However, as I listened more carefully, I discovered in myself and later in my students that underlying all of these struggles was fear. So I will comment on this. When he says fear, so I'm not sure I'm going to agree with that exactly, because what I sense happens is that there is fear, but what is the fear of is the question, right? What are we fearing? And to me, and maybe he gets to this, is that is feeling what's going on. We're afraid of feeling. That's what my experience is. And that when I have to let go of the fear to allow myself to feel, and then I have to somehow make space to feel. So in the next section, he calls it expand the field of attention. He says, if there are a few basic principles for learning how to open to our stuck places and release the contradictions of the body of fear. The first of these principles is called expanding the field of attention. A repeated difficulty will be predominantly felt in one of the four basic areas of mindfulness. Expanding the field of attention requires that we become aware of another dimension of the insistent visitor and not just notice its predominant face. This is because invariably we are stuck on a different level from the obvious one we have been noticing and naming. Release will only take place when we can shift from that which is obvious to one of the other levels of awareness. So what I think he means by what's obvious is that, oh, I'm angry, I'm sad, and like just sort of like, well, rather than the actual like raw experience. He says, on retreats, we call these insistent visitors or difficult, repetitive thought patterns the top 10 tunes. Normally, when thinking arises, we can simply name it thinking, thinking, and in the light of awareness, it will vanish like a cloud. However, the top 10 tunes, whether as words, images, or stories, will persist and return no matter how often they are noticed. They play like records, repeating a theme over and over. At first, we gain perspective. We can number them 1 through 10. In that way, when we notice them, we don't have to play the record all the way through each time. Or we can use a variation of a technique of giving a humorous title. However, that is not enough. Suppose we encounter a repeated story. I'm sorry, I don't want to read all these. Okay. So he then says, how does this thought feel in our body? Now we're getting somewhere. Sorry, there's somebody in the waiting room. Allow them in. Oh, there is a tightness in the diaphragm in the chest. We can name this. See, he's still sort of, this is 30 some years ago, and he's still like using the Mahasi Sayadaw noting method. And I don't think he would probably say the same thing today, but maybe. We can name this because I'm not all into naming, because as soon as you verbalize stuff, it can get you into your thinking mind, which then takes you away from the feeling experience. And so it's that while the naming it can be useful to depersonalize the experience, oh, it's just thinking, it's just a feeling, to kind of like get some distance from it, it also takes you out of kind of, I'll say the heart, but out of the just feeling it into thinking about it. So careful. Okay. We can name this tightness, and stay meticulously attentive for some time. As we do, it may open to other sensations. Now we're talking about some difficult feeling, right? And many new images and feelings will be released. In this way, we can first begin to release the physical contractions and bodily fear that we have held. Then we can expand the attention further to new feelings, what feelings arise along with this thought pattern and this tightness. At first, they may be half hidden or unconscious, but if we sense carefully, the feelings will begin to show themselves. The tightness in the chest will become sadness, and the sadness may become grief. As we finally begin to grieve, the pattern will release. In a similar way, when we encounter a repeated physical pain or difficult mood, we can expand awareness to the level of thoughts, the story or belief that comes with it. With careful attention, we may find a subtle belief about ourselves that perpetuates the pain or mood, perhaps a story about our unworthiness. This is very interesting because someone was just texting me, and I just put my phone in the other room, but on Sunday about some feelings that they were struggling with, some depressive feelings, and do I have any suggestions about how to deal with that? And this is a friend and someone that, see quite, I'm in touch with regularly, and it was interesting. They were going to a meditation group, and afterward they were like, oh, I started to see that I do this victim thing, and it's very much what and then later they were like, oh, I'm realizing like this is kind of connected to my mother, and then there's like a story, but they were like, and I know that's not the whole what's happening now, but it's like it was like they were sort of seeing the layers of it, and it was very interesting. It was very similar to what Jack is referring to. So here again, repeated thoughts and stories are almost always fueled by an unacknowledged emotion or feeling underneath. I mean, we could just use that for our practice. Repeated thoughts and stories are almost always fueled by an unacknowledged emotion or feeling underneath. These unsensed feelings are part of what brings the thought back time and again. Future planning is usually fueled by anxiety. Remembering of the past is often fueled by regret or guilt or grief. Many fantasies arise as a response to pain or emptiness. The task in meditation is to drop below the level of the repeated recorded message to sense and feel the energy that brings it up. When we can do this and truly come to terms with the feeling, the thought will no longer need to arise and the pattern will naturally fade away. Well, the last sentence is just one of those things you write in order to wrap up a section of a book. It's not reality, but it's nice. Having written such sentences at the end of sections, I'm familiar with the need. I have to wrap this up and make it feel like it's all done. No, I mean, it's called repeated visitors, right? It's like, yeah, that you see them, you connect. Okay, good. It dissipates. I've cleared that up. Next week, back for, rerun. So fine, because the point is the practice, right? Is to learn how we hold with these things, how we live with these things. And I talk about this, and sometimes people don't like to hear it. Somebody was complaining about this recently. I don't like it, but I find it somewhat amusing when people, resist things that I'm like, I'm just teaching like the Dharma. I'm not trying to make it hard for you. I'm sorry. Like, as, and so this is something version of what people find some resistance to, which is my experience is that as we get older, it's not that we shed all these things, it's rather that we learn how to hold them. And that there are certain traumas, certain wounds, certain aspects of our life that we carry with us. And when we're at some point in our life, they may be real burdens and things that we struggle with, and or they cause confusion and all. But spiritual maturity, if I can use such a term, to me is not about, oh, I've let it all go. It's about, oh, I can, it's like he, as he says, expanding the field of attention. It's okay. These are, you know, these are wounds that, like scars, like, and you know, you don't, it's not like the scar disappears, it fades, it just becomes, it's not an active wound, you know, it's just something that's part of your history and that may kind of bubble up in some ways. And yeah, I mean, sure, there are probably things that some of us completely let go of, and that's great. But I think it's also helpful. For me, it's helpful to not have this black and white thinking, like if there is still some vestige of some past wound or some kind of pain that shows up from time to time, to think, oh, I failed. You know, or I'm not doing it right, or I need to figure this out and get rid of it. But rather to think, oh, you know, there it is. There's this thing that's like, you know, like a wrinkle on my face. Like, yeah, it just shows that I've lived, you know. It's the way that people talk about, like, the aged face with the wrinkles. It's like, well, you can see it as one thing, as this old person, you know, deteriorating, or you can see it as life's experience etched into this face. And we could say that there's that same etching happens in our heart, in our whatever it is that carries these feelings, in our nervous system, I don't know. And that it's okay. You know, I think that is the illusions of youth, that there is some perfection that one is going to attain to, that's going to, you know, we're going to get it all figured out, right? Every shot's going to be a hole in one, you know. I mean, when people talk about what's the perfect golf score, it's 18. You know, you get a hole in one on every hole. But no, that's not, it's not golf. That's not life. Sorry. I had to slip in my golf reference, you know. And I find this teaching really, really valuable. And it, as those who know me, which many of you, no, are, well, I'm sure I recognize that this is very much what I teach, this idea of holding and being with, and how to do that. And what's hard about teaching it from my standpoint is that it is a nonverbal thing. We're talking about the experience is nonverbal. The, like, the pain or the feeling, the dukkha that we're talking about is nonverbal. It's not like a thought. It's really an underlying feeling. And then the way to work with that is also nonverbal. That's, again, that's why, like, the noting it as thinking or whatever isn't really the solution. You know, that's not what we're working with here. We have to learn to operate in this felt realm, which is very unfamiliar for most humans, frankly. And for addicts and people in recovery, it can be very uncomfortable because, well, guess what? Why were we drinking and using in the first place? Because we had feelings we didn't like, that we wanted to get away from, that we wanted to suppress. And now we're being asked to turn toward them and let them in. And that can seem not just unpleasant, but dangerous. Now, this is not for the newcomers, for certainly, and as I sometimes like to point out, my teaching isn't really directed to newcomers. If newcomers come, that is their right and their business. But what I'm offering is meant for people who have been around the block and have been in recovery for a while, and have worked with some spiritual practices for a while, and and basically are at this kind of crossroads that Jack is talking about, where you've dealt with a lot of stuff and there's been some evolution, but then it's like, whoa, there's another layer here. And how do I work with that? And I'm hoping that what I offer is of some value and some use in that process. So I will leave it there. And oh, what is the Kabir poem? All right. Well, now that you've asked, I'll read the Kabir poem. Thank you, Charmaine. And by the way, and thank you, Charmaine. And you know why I'm saying that. Excuse me. Okay. Friend, please tell me what I can do about this world I hold to and keep spinning at and keep spinning out. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day the cloth was well woven. So I bought some burlap, but I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I am greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I am proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds on to one thing. That's Kabir, yeah. It's from the Robert Bly's The Kabir Book. It is called a collection of poems. So I will open it up. We have a little time left if anyone wants to share. Steve, I'm glad you got on board here. It looked like you were having a really hard time getting in. I kept clicking you in and
There's my Zoom thing on my laptop has just been driving me crazy this last few days. I don't know what's going on. It works on the PC in the house and it doesn't work here. And it's too long to, it's just Zoom, it's computers.
It sounds like Dooka to me.
It's complete dukkha. Absolutely frustrating. I really, this computer is going to follow me in my car down the highway and I'm going to chuck it out the window and I'm going to get a new one.
Okay, but that would be littering, so it's illegal,
Okay.
but yeah.
We'll
Thanks.
put it in
Well,
the landfill box.
I'm glad you made it in.
Nice to be here.
Claire has asked somebody to link the poem or book or author, so if anybody it's the Kabir Book by Robert Bly. I'm going to leave that to the community to solve. Anyone else want to have a word in here? I mean, I would like to hear if this stuff makes sense. If people are like, yep, get it. That's what I'm working with. Deborah gets it. Okay, thank you. Thanks for the nod. Good, Mimi. Okay, good.
Can
All
I
right,
say
well,
something?
please do.
Oh my God. This is just unbelievable. I've got like 31 years sober. I've been involved in the last 6 years with a legal conflict that has just taken me down. And it's why like I'm here with you. It was sort of like, anything to help. And it just completely echoes every part of the legal conflict echoes, what happened when I was a kid and wasn't touched in an 8-year analysis. And what you're talking about, I mean, when you said fear, it was like, yes. And everything you said was just like bingo, 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 bingo. And it's just brought such relief. I kept thinking, like, oh my God, I hope you're recording this well because I'm just going to keep coming back to it over and over. I mean, for me, you just got to the distillation of suffering. Thank you so much.
Good. Thanks, Mimi. I appreciate it. I mean it's really just, it's just sharing, really. Eleanor, go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Kevin. Good morning,
Hello.
everybody. Kevin, thank you for reporting that part in Jack's book. It reminded me of a moment in my learning to meditate. I was sitting with a group in North Berkeley, not your group, trying to learn how to do the mindfulness meditation with the phrases. And one day I'm focusing on a family member, and I said, focusing on that family member, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be free from suffering, you bitch. And I just, that was like a moment of me saying, it's nice to have that aspiration. It's nice to have that intention to be loving. And in this moment, I can't pull it off. So, and that's, I love that reminder because I can now address loving kindness to that particular family member without that coming up, which is progress for me. And I love the part you said about the Kabir poem. Thank you for reading that because I'm experiencing a lot right now that I'm so proud of myself for being so so mindful, and then I'm depressed because I'm residing in pride, and it's just great. It's just like dukkha dukkha all over the place. It's part of being alive. I like being alive.
Well, don't get too attached to it. That's all I can say.
Like Mary Helen, I'm also old, so there you go.
Yeah, I'm getting there. Now I was thinking, like, what is it? It's so interesting that, the way you were talking about, like, doing loving kindness and finding yourself drawn into the aversive side of it, and what to do with that. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of things that can be done with it, and both on the feeling level and on the reflective level, just to, and as you sort of seem to indicate, sort of on the acceptance, like, oh, well, this is where this is right now, but it's dukkha for me, so, and that's where we reflect on the Four Noble Truths, like, oh, right, my being this. This anger is not hurting that person, it's hurting me right now. And so maybe that's why I like the term non-ill will sometimes, rather than, offering loving kindness. Thanks. Steve.
Yeah, thanks for that reading out of that. I mean, I like what you said when you started talking about, because I remember when I first read Jack's book, A Path with Heart, it was probably one of the most impactful books I've ever read in my life. And I was going through some serious transitions at that time. And I remember I was at a out at the coast just north at Albion, staying just north of Sea Ranch, and I was staying out there going through this thing, and I dealing with my mom, and I read that book and I cried for 3 days nonstop. I cried for 3 days nonstop. And then when you talked about this layering, every time I think I've got all this stuff washed out and I've got it figured out and I feel better, the next layer of crap comes up. It's like the Grand Canyon of life. You just go through these layers and layers and layers. And so when you mentioned that when you read that section of the book, it just took me right back to, wow, I'm going to be 75 next month, and it's like I'm getting older, and this stuff just keeps coming up. It doesn't go away, so you just kind of have to work with it and wash it out and just deal with it. But thanks for that. That was just a really nice talk. I appreciate it.
I'll say two things. One is a bit of a, supposed to be funny, which is that I recall when I was younger, if someone like who was like 60 was like in therapy, I'd be like, why are you bothering with therapy? You're already so old. What's the point? But that layering you referred to is actually in the sutta, the removing of distracting thoughts, which has five strategies for removing distracting thoughts. One of them, the Buddha describes, he says, it's as if someone were running and they thought to themselves, why am I running? Why don't I walk? And then they were walking and then they thought, why am I walking? Why don't I just stop and stand? And then standing, they thought, why am I standing? Why don't I just sit down? And sitting down, they thought, why am I sitting down? Why don't I just lie down? And remember reading that sutta and thinking about it and thinking, oh, this is about calming yourself down, which is sort of, like using your breath to just keep calmer, make yourself calmer and calmer. But there's a note from Bhikkhu Bodhi in the back of the book that explains, no, this is actually about looking at underlying causality. So this what Jack is kind of getting at. It's like he's kind of using that teaching in a more, direct and modern sort of way. But this is, a kind of a good like tool in practice is to just ask yourself what's underneath that and what's underneath that, and not looking for some verbal answer, but a feeling answer. And sometimes the feeling will emerge as an understanding, like, oh, this is that. Like my friend who texted me the other day saying, oh, I realized that this depression I was having was like tied up with being a victim. And then seeing, oh, that's connected to my relationship to my mother and that sort of thing, where you're making connections, but you're not like, sitting there kind of doing therapy on yourself, but just kind of breathing with and experiencing and being clear and allowing feelings to be there, letting go of resistance. And then the mind naturally kind of intuitively sometimes gets some clarity, sometimes not. And personally, I don't think it's necessary. I've pretty much lost interest in causality in terms of like my history, like what is it that my family did, because they were this, they were alcoholics or they were whatever, that's why I'm like this kind of thing. Is like, yeah, well, okay, good. But now what? Now I'm sitting here with this feeling. Now the important thing to me is, what do I do with this feeling right here and now? All that past stuff is gone. It can be helpful to have some understanding, to not, because I think being confused about stuff, about why am I in these states, that is troubling. And it is helpful to have some logical, psychological sort of explanation of things. But at the end of the day, once you have that, then you still have to just confront and be with the feelings themselves. And that's where I think this practice is incredibly valuable. So thank you all for dropping in on a Tuesday morning. I shall return this next Tuesday. This weekend I'll be up in Grass Valley at Mountain Stream Meditation Center for those who attend or would like to attend or drop up, fly out from Georgia, Tanya. Okay. Well,
Welcome home.
yeah, it won't be as hot as Atlanta, I'm guessing. So,
Would love to.
yeah, you're welcome. Anyway, thanks everybody, and see you all soon.
Thank you,
Huge
Kevin.
thank you.
See you next
Thank you,
week.
Kevin.
Okay, take care.
Thanks,
Hopefully, my
Dennis.
Zoom will be fixed.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you all.